The views expressed on AM360 by the host, hostesses, or guests are their own and not necessarily the position of AM360 or the parent corporation, the Community-Wide Share Conference, CWSC Incorporated. AM360 content is intended as a community service and is not designed to provide specific and personal medical, financial, or legal counsel or other professional advice, and no liability shall extend to the host or hostesses of AM360 or CWSC. We encourage you to consult an advisor for your specific circumstances.
You have listened to us over 500,000 times. American Muslim 360.
That's interesting.
Assalamu alaikum. This is American Muslim 360 radio broadcast.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Ar-Rahmanir Rahim. مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
American Muslim 360 is
too legit, too legit to quit.
We will never quit. American Muslim 360, your number one Muslim radio station.
You can't touch this. You can't touch this.
Community-Wide Shura Conference and American Muslim 360 invites you to promote your organization or event on the number one Islamic radio station in the nation. Affordable rates allow you to promote your event and strengthen our national intelligentsia network. Contact corporate underwriting today at cwsconline@gmail.com. That's cwsconline@gmail.com. Or call 910-317-0297. Again, 910-317-0297. Together we can remake the world.
Have you ever heard the phrase, don't drink and drive? Just imagine the health care costs and the lives or the families and marriages and careers that maybe, just maybe, could have been saved if we just changed the sentence to two words instead of four. Don't drink. A public service message from American Muslim 360 and CWSC.
I'm Mark Shaheed, the host and facilitator for the Courtship and Marriage Learning Lab.
And I'm Sister Manira Habio, co-facilitator for the Courtship and Marriage Learning Lab.
If you have questions, comments in regards to courtship and marriage, to bring your questions and comments to the lab as we provide information and education on the do's and don'ts of courtship and also the key essential ingredients to what constitutes a healthy marriage.
Please join us on Tuesday evening, 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 Central, and 4 Pacific Time. We look forward to having you on the show.
Assalamu alaikum.
Are you the looking for a mate or blessed with one? Join us the weekend of March 15th for Marriage with Pastor Dean, Married and Single Social, at the lovely Crown Plaza Hotel in St. Louis. Al Mufanu Islamic Center invites you to a weekend of social gatherings, workshops, panel discussions, culture entertainment, sightseeing, a banquet, and more. To register, contact Radia Mukman at 314-283-0417. Again, that's 314-283-0417. You can also contact Medina Wakil at 314-330-4481. Again, that is 314-330-4481. Or you can go online at marriagesinglesocial.eventbrite.com.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. One moment, getting feedback. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah wa ahdahu la sharika lahu wa ashhadu anna Muhammadan abduhu wa rasuluhu. Assalamu alaikum, dear listening audience, and welcome. This is Martha Naila Abdullah, and this morning, the best of the best. What we were wanting to present this morning was an interview of Mukta Muhammad on the Not Just Talk show. So we're having difficulty with that, so we will share with you one of the best of the best. This is from, I believe it is, the Open Forum. Perhaps you've heard the Open Forum with Amadou Shakur. So we want you to enjoy this, inshallah. Stay tuned. After this presentation, then Healing and Harmony for Humankind with Mother Sister Dr. Baiza Muhammad will be coming to us. Of course, this is the fifth day. We did not get the question in for the fourth day, fourth and fifth, so inshallah we will look to having that presented here. There are two questions, so look forward to that for the AM360 History Challenge question. Give me one moment here. All right, well, make do, everyone. We're working with new equipment here. All right, well, we won't be long anything. Since we can't find, we'll go here with a presentation from the imam.
Ma'am, while the imam is coming to the mic, I'd like to just do my little brief introduction, if I may. This human world that we are living in is becoming more clear and refreshing as each day come and go. No thirst comes without a quencher. More important, the man who truly understands the life and works of Prophet Muhammad the last, and that's no other than Imam W.D. Muhammad. Takbir!
Brother Thomas, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to the Open Forum. I'm Amadou Shakur. I work with the International Museum of Muslim Cultures. I'm speaking to you from Charlotte, North Carolina, although our museum is located in Jackson, Mississippi, where in February we have two large conferences coming up, I hope of interest. The first one is called Timbuktu to Niger to Mississippi, The Legacy of Literacy and Music to the Americas, and the other is Slavery and Its Legacy. We'll talk more about that hopefully later in the show. My guest this evening is Dr. Alan Austin. Dr. Austin, good evening. How are you?
Good evening. Good evening, Amadou. I'm very good.
Glad that you could join us this evening. The Open Forum is an opportunity. My pleasure to be interviewing people like yourself. We hope to be interviewing as the series unfolds, people of accomplishment that have made a contribution to the American Muslim Ummah and to America in general. Let me remind our listeners, you are listening to the American Muslim 360, and I'm going to open up the phones later in the show to speak with my guest, Dr. Alan Austin, who is a retired professor from Springfield College, retired in 1999. His PhD was earned at the University of Massachusetts in 1975, and Dr. Austin has written and lectured on a wide variety of African-American subjects. This evening, we're going to talk a lot about his book, African Muslims in Antebellum America. The first one, a large compilation, is called A Source Book, and the latter, a smaller version, Transatlantic Stories and Spiritual Struggles. Dr. Austin, we've got a lot to talk about this evening, but I think a good place may be to start with your interest and when you began this discipline, when you started the work on African Muslims in antebellum America. What got you started? Why?
What got me started was that I was teaching in California on an Indian reservation, Native American reservation, and a pamphlet came out and talked about the Negro in American history textbooks, and it pretty clearly pointed out that they barely appeared. That is, as individuals, they were problems that needed to people that needed help. People that didn't do much for themselves but had to be lifted up and were carried around, unless maybe they were half white, like Frederick Douglass. And it was a time when, that was 1965, it was a time when there was little thought that people could find out what any African American had done in slavery or that or where he came from or any questions such as that. But then I started looking into it for my interracial children. My son and I visited Senegal and the Gambia in response to the roots, Alex Haley's roots, which I was teaching. And eventually I found a fair amount of information on Africans who had told their story on this side of the Atlantic and told something about where they had come from in Africa. So I started putting that together and then found that very little had been written about African Muslims who had come over here, despite the fact that there were lots of scattered pieces of information that I had collected. It just had not been put together. There had been a book or two about individual African Muslims, but much more needed to be done. So eventually, to make this shorter, I produced a 759-page collection of gathered materials related to eight chapters dealing with individuals who about whom we know quite a bit, and then some 55 or so that we knew a bit about, but only a paragraph or a sentence or a reference. That was in 1984. 759 pages, single-spaced, is a lot of information that should have been looked at before, and it would have been discovered that there were a number of people brought over here who had skills, intelligence, spiritual lives, activities, knowledge about Africa, a place that in our maps was vacant and absent. Timbuktu was a place that was considered only way out there, almost unreachable and not understandable, when it was, of course, an intellectual center at the time. And so my information was an attempt, by looking at these individuals and the other pieces that we could put together, to see what these people had, in fact, been able to do, where they had learned the information that it was implied they only learned over on this side of the Atlantic, and who they ran into, who started telling their stories and only how much and how much of their stories. Usually these people only wanted to find useful things for themselves. If they were missionaries, they took down some information that might be helpful to their cause. If they were somebody who was interested in some other aspect of African Americans, then they would take that down. But not much was put together until that book. So that was that's sort of what started me off, and it grew from an article into this massive collection.
So what you're saying is there was not much of an interest or an appetite at that time. Have you seen that appetite increase? And why do you think that Americans, even today, are not as intrigued as we are with the history of Islam in Africa, the Muslim high regard for literacy, and as you mentioned, Timbuktu, the golden era of Timbuktu, where great accomplishments, great contributions were made to physics and geometry and jurisprudence, an era that before René Carrier got to Timbuktu was flourishing while Europe was going through its cathartic period, the Middle Ages. This interest and this appetite, am I missing something here, or is America?
No, I think you're not. Excuse me, I don't mean to interrupt, but as you say, there's a lot of area to cover. It is interesting that as we, when I first started this, nobody was interested. When I finished the book, I thought, well, here's something that's really going to rock the historians. American historians, and it took 3 years before I began to get any real responses. There are two books written about two African Muslims who had their own Muslim communities on the island of Sapelo and St. Simon's Island in Georgia in the 1840s and 50s. They're barely mentioned in histories of their purchasers. The purchasers were famous around America and England and even into Sweden, and yet there was some interest in those particular people, but almost it was very little noticed. The people in the revolution, a number of revolutionary American revolutionary people, were interested in Islam and Muslims. Ben Franklin and a book about the Algerines and the Algerine captivities. A lot of, as you may know, a lot of operas and musical performances were produced about trying to capture and recapture stories of powerful and dangerous, threatening Muslims in the 18th and then the early 19th century. Byron talks about this, Lord Byron. There are a lot of instances early on showing that people were interested in this. But, of course, there were Europeans going down and making a lot of money off what they could steal out of Africa. Gold, people, gum arabic, and the knowledge of how to grow cotton, indigo, and rice, the three major products that the Americans produced, when, of course, they knew nothing about it. I mean, the Europeans produced. They didn't grow any of those products. They learned how to grow those things, in part, through watching and learning from the Africans who were brought over here from West Africa, several of whom, 20% or so, maybe more, were African Muslims, or at least had been influenced by the Africans who had adopted or been around Muslims in that area. Now, what I'm saying is there was a bit of a time around the time of the American Revolution. And then, of course, everything closed up when it looked like the cotton gin came along in 1815 and earlier 1793, and people began to be interested in what they could get out of people who are not going to be paid and were brought over here, they weren't interested in what they knew or understood or what religion they had or anything else. They just wanted to use them up. But there are instances where on Sapelo and Simon's Island, for instance, the plantation managers that produced a lot of the wealth from those two islands, where the owners became famous for their productions, were managed for 4 and 5 months at a time without their white masters being there at all. And this is in a private letter, of course. It did not get out and was not advertised until maybe the 1940. Somebody found that, but the new historians just produced within the last 10 years, the new histories of those two families barely mention that fact. So there's more to be done. What you're saying is, I think, clearly people are beginning now to see that, in fact, early America wasn't as bound to, say, Christianity or the kinds of Christianity that came over here. We're more interested in the larger world until slavery really came down hard and production became more important than people. But now, again, we have many more immigrants from Arabic country, Arabic speaking and Arabic related and connected, and Morocco and so forth, areas where Islam is important and where it may be the next kind of thing that we really need to understand and try to teach people about. They've got to begin to start finding out more about this population.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. You've got Yaro Mahmood on the cover of your book, African Muslims in Antebellum America.
Right.
I want to ask you about that. Before, let me remind our audience that you're listening to American Muslim 360. My name is Amadou Shakur. I'm with the International Museum of Muslim Cultures. My guest, Dr. Alan Austin. Tell me about Yaro Mahmood.
Yaro Mahmood is one of those people about whom one wishes we could know more. He was noticed around Annapolis, Maryland. He was brought into Annapolis, Maryland, apparently. And then around 1815, 1819, he was beginning to approach old age, but and was identified as a person who was an unusual person. He would talk about staying away from bad habits and bad diets, and pork was bad, and he would pray, and people began to recognize that he was somebody that had a kind of culture, though he must have been away from Africa for some time at that point. He was painted by one of the earliest great American painters, Charles Wilson Peale, in 1819. And then in 1822 or 23, he was painted by a lesser artist. But he became a man of interest because he had a kind of, he was a character with that had dignity and was not, you could not say that here was a good Christian old man. Here was a good Muslim man. And they recognized that here was a Muslim. And it's an important kind of story. He earned his own freedom working out of his owner's, his purchaser's obligation. And then he saved money and then gave it to a bank and then lost it, but then worked very hard and got it back again. So he was known also as a persevering, persistent man, as well as and probably because, and at least that they attributed it, and it seems reasonable, that he was an honest Muslim. There's not much more known about him.
Absolutely. You've got several historical figures in your book. How many are there? Up to 40, perhaps? perhaps?
Well, in the there are, as I say, there are chapters dealing with eight particular individuals in the smaller book. In the larger book, I refer to some were important from Jamaica, from Trinidad, and from Latin America. But the important characters, there's a chapter, enough information about several of them to write chapters. Job ben Solomon, way back in 1730 and 1734, worked with the first respectable, mostly respectable, translator of the Quran into English, George Sale, way back in 1734. He was brought to Annapolis, as Yarrow had been, and made a slave. He ran away. He started writing on walls. People recognized that it was Arabic, and he was encouraged by the founder of Georgia, James Oglethorpe, and helped to get to England. On the way, he wrote a Quran, and then he appears to have written two others. One of them existed at least as late as 1789, because we have a reference to it. He was admired by and visited with the King and Queen of England, and his character, his dignity, his apparent obvious pride, his spirituality encouraged people to try to talk to him and to see if he could help them understand some Arabic manuscripts that had gotten to England. One of the founders of the British Museum found it interesting to talk to Job ben Solomon. And Job wrote what should be considered the first African-American piece of literature. It's an as-told-to story, and he told the Englishman who was writing down what he said, write down exactly what I say, and don't try to change it. So he was very serious. He got returned to Africa, became a kind of agent for the British against the French in Senegal, from where he had come. His is a fascinating story. It is known and was known. There are two portraits of him. I reproduce the portraits of these people, of as many as I can find, and reproduce some of their documents in Arabic, and have made maps to show where they came from and where they went to here. Another important person after him was Abdul Rahman, as the conference we're both going to in Mississippi says, from Timbuktu. His family was from Timbuktu. They moved to what is now Guinea, Fouta Djallon, and he had a family. He was a soldier. And then he got caught up in a battle, was taken from the Gambia to Natchez, Mississippi. He and a companion named Suleiman, as soon as they got their land legs back, ran away, found no place to go. But shortly thereafter, an Englishman who his father had helped on the coast of Guinea, who had a leg wound, came to Natchez, Mississippi, recognized him. They recognized each other. He tried to purchase him and was not able to. But at the age of 65, that man was freed and came, traveled from Natchez, Mississippi, with his wife, who was paid to be free by Natchez citizens. He was brought all the way across the northern part of America, met with blacks in Boston, New York, and Philadelphia, visited and was traveled with Secretary of State Clay, met President John Quincy Adams, who gave him a little bit of money, but not as much as he wanted. He eventually returned to Africa. But he said on the way to the Christians who were asking him to write what they thought was the Lord's Prayer. It was actually a bit of the Fatiha and other pieces from the Quran, that Why do you try to get me to do this? Your Christians don't always do as we do back home in Africa. Where do you find in your law that people should work 5 days a week, seven days a week, not have any breaks, and be treated as badly as they are here? He was daring enough to criticize, too. And somehow, Amadou, this is fascinating, somehow he kept up with the history of his family and country, even though supposedly there were no connections. That's one of the interesting things that we haven't chased down yet. He was returned to Africa, died a month later, but five of his offspring did get to Liberia, and his wife.
Abdurrahman, portrayed in the film made by Unity Production Foundation, Prince Among Slaves, narrated.
Yes, a wonderful production.
Absolutely. You even mentioned in your book, I think back in the 70s, that his story should have been made into a movie, and I guess
yes.
You were looking into your ball. You
yes.
say here
yes.
In your chapter on Abdurrahman, from long before Ar-Rahman's birth, the Fulbe and their sometime allies had been constantly at war, usually on the defensive. Finally, however, in years that would be similarly significant in North America, 1776 to 1778, Sori managed to consolidate his then victorious armies and powers and to create not only the strongest nation of its time in that area, but a safe haven for some of the most influential Islamic scholars in West Africa. And you conclude by saying, with a basis in trade and agriculture, including capturing, utilizing, and selling slaves, this political and economic empire was closely related to the Atlantic trade in Africans.
Yes. Yeah, he was returned to Africa in 1829, and after traveling across North America with missionaries and preachers leaning all over him to make him become a Christian and carry Christianity back to Africa. He wasn't amazed or overpowered or overwhelmed by all this. He, as soon as he got back to Africa, of course, he declared that he was still a Muslim. And he had never, ever pretended to be anything but that. But this man and the times he lived in were very important. And what we find out is that a book called The Slave, not a slave smuggler, but a book by a Frenchman who published in 1854 his life, talked about meeting, going to Timbo, the hometown of Bilali Muhammad and Abdurrahman, and trading for victims of slave captures and so forth. So we know quite a bit about the Sori family, and it would be wonderful if that writer had known that one of them had gotten to Natchez, Mississippi, and returned to Africa, so that we could fill out more of the story. But Abdurrahman went to talk to a Yale professor, and the Yale professor asked him to write in Arabic, and he did. And the Yale professor said that he handled the language very beautifully. Then let me tell you that man got to Hartford. It's amazing at the age of 65 to travel as he did in 1828. But he got to Hartford, and there, one of the most famous American portrait painters painted his portrait. That portrait was seen in 1867 by Mark Twain, and Mark Twain wrote this pretty disgusting description. He retold Abdurrahman's story, and then he said, "I hope the man is back in West Africa selling niggers or eating," and that's the way he put it, "or eating the ones he couldn't sell." 1867.
Wa alaikum salam, Brother Thomas.
Yeah, we have a caller. Thought that might be a good break right there. Anyway, alhamdulillah, loving it, loving it. Let's just get this mic on. Area code 347, you're on American Muslim 360, listening to the open forum. State your name and where you're calling from. Area code 347. Okay, maybe they pushed one by mistake. Okay, go ahead. I apologize.
Okay, very good. You know, throughout your book, it's very apparent that many of these captives and ex-captives came in contact with very influential Americans. Case in point, you were just speaking about Abdurrahman and Henry Clay, President Henry Clay, Omar Ibn Said, who spent 53 years in Fayetteville, North Carolina, on the estate of Governor James Owen. But from your research, Dr. Austin, was it apparent that although many Americans saw Africans as subhumans, godless, irreligious savages with no culture of value, but with Muslims, they seemed very fascinated with the culture, the religion, and even the resistance.
Sad to say, I tried to suggest it a bit earlier that some of these people became interesting, and as Omar did, to an owner, not General Owen, but his brother purchased Omar. Omar Ibn Said, who had been brought from Senegal at the age of 37, was on the wrong side in the war and was taken to Charleston, South Carolina. His first master was not too difficult, was, as Omar said, religious, but the second one was bad, and he ran away. And in a couple months, he found himself in Fayetteville, North Carolina. In Fayetteville, North Carolina, there were some men who noticed something special about Omar, and particularly the one who fought with, had to go to court apparently in order to get him from his previous owner, and bought him and treated him for the last, let's see, he went from age 37 to, he died in 1863, so last 30 years or so, kept him as a kind of, how shall we say, a kind of pet. He did not make him work hard. He apparently recognized, in fact, that this isn't somebody that ought to be made to work hard. He could write. In 1819, he wrote this very beautiful two-page manuscript, which I copy in the two books. He apparently had written before that, and the manuscript is the Al-Mulk, and chapter of the Quran, and other pieces from the Quran and from other texts that he had dealt with as a teacher and trader back in Senegal. But he, many Christian missionaries came around, partly to talk to him, but to get him to convert to Christianity. And so there's a big contest. From the first writings we have about him, 1819, all the way to 1919,
my veil shows my condition. God is my addiction.
Modesty. You look at me with a turned up nose. You whisper how you don't like my clothes. You wonder why I'm dressed from my head to my toes. You wonder why my breasts are not exposed. Modesty is my code of honor, a level of respect that I expect. My body I choose to protect, So maybe it's time that you reflect. My true beauty lies within, not in how you see my skin. I wear these clothes by choice, but it does not mean I have no voice. My success is my state of mind. I stand tall, sweet, gentle, and refined, while out in the world on my grind. I am skilled and knowledgeable, and I have class. My worth and beauty is in measure in how I shake my ass. I empower myself to do my best. It is you that I'm not trying to impress. So if you ask me if I'm hot, I say hell yes. But modesty is in the way I dress. For I'm not in a fashion contest. As you parade and the men degrade, and you often live alone and all afraid, maybe it's time that you upgrade. I adjust my veil with precision. I take pride in my decision. For it is my honor, it is my duty to guard myself in all my beauty. My veil shows my conviction. God is my addiction. Unwanted glances and advances. This veil is my protection. So if you have any objections, I have one suggestion. That you, yes, you, look in a different direction.
My veil shows my condition. God is my addiction. God is my addiction.
And welcome, dear listening audience. This is the best of the best from the archives of American Muslim 360 broadcast. And now we're going to present two questions. And by all means, if you're listening by way of the 24-hour streaming, you can now dial in to 515-605-9891. Join in, if you will, answering the question. And this is the American Muslim 360 History Challenge question. And if you're having problems dialing in the 515, just in case, another number for joining us in the studio is 425-292-4253. Again, it's 425-292-4253. Now, the hosts of American Muslim 360 are excluded from answering the question. So we appreciate your hearing it and joining in and making comments, please, by all means. All right, the first one is, and I shall read, Pole Explorer. The flag hung down. A little wind lifted it. The wind opened it. The flag waved in the wind. It spoke to the world. What did it say? It said that two Americans erected the North Pole. They had reached the top of the world. The North Pole. Commander Peary reached the North Pole. But Blank helped Peary. Peary took trips to far places. So who, oh, what is the name of the person who reached the North Pole along with Commander Peary? Known as the North Pole Explorer, and erected the flag, indicate speaking loud that Americans had made it. All right, we have one's in the queue here. We'll go to a caller. 317-299.
Yeah, assalamu alaikum. Ron Foster Sharif calling from Indianapolis, Indiana. Sister, that was
alaikum
Matthew. That was Matthew Alexander Henson. He was also, I think, the great, or either the great-great-grandfather of Taraji P. Henson. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you, alaikum assalam, and you are so correct, alhamdulillah. I didn't expect that to be so quickly, but alhamdulillah, thank you so very much, and we'll get your information and share with you the commemorative calendar. Thank you, Brother Ron Foster Sharif.
And can I offer a suggestion?
Oh, yes, you may.
Yeah, when you state the question before you move on, can you restate it a second time? I missed it the other day the first time, and I just needed to hear what was the question. So if you could restate it two times, that would be very helpful. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum.
Oh, thank you. Alaikum assalam. Thank you very, very much, and will do. And the second question, I will do just that. So you stay with us there, too. And Mark Shahid, you had comments, knowing that the hosts, of course, are... Okay. Mark Shahid, did you have comments to make?
No, I forgot I was a host of AM360. Thank you, Martha.
You're quite welcome.
I'm always ready to answer. So, alhamdulillah. Congratulations to our brother for the correct answer there. And, you know, just so many things that we actually accomplish. And if we don't know our history, we can't fault anyone but ourselves now, you know, because we have to realize the importance and the value. You know, of ourselves and our contributions, not only for African American people, but for America, the country, and also for the world of humanity. And inshallah, this month, a lot of these things will be brought out in this month that perhaps many of us just were not aware of. So thank you. Excellent question.
Alhamdulillah. Thank you. All right. So we'll get to the second question.
Congratulations, my good friend Ron Foster Sharif. It shows that he knows his history.
Praise be to Allah. All right. We go to the second question. Thank you, Mark. All right. Dear listening audience, you were listening to Amadou Shakur before and his guest. And I apologize, the name just gets away from me. But let's go on. Quite informative, and the book. So this will be, it's in the archives, and it will be reshared, inshallah, on the rotation on the 24-hour streaming. So we go to now, I want the name of the young lady. She was known as a national youth worker, all right? I'll read this way because it may be quite obvious with her name, but we'll go like this. Blank worked in the cotton field. She worked in her bare feet. Her parents worked in the cotton fields too. Her parents worked in the cotton fields of South Carolina. They were slaves before Blank was born. Blank walked 5 miles to school every day. A few years later, Blank started her own school. She started a school in Florida. Now this school is called, and I'm going to make this a two-part question,
Now this school is called Who Is She? I'll read again. National Youth Worker. Blank worked in the cotton fields. She worked in her bare feet. Her parents worked in the cotton fields too. Her parents worked in the cotton fields of South Carolina. They were slaves before Blank was born. Blank walked 5 miles to school every day. A few years later, Blank started her own school. She started a school in Florida. Now this school is called, press one on your phone, and we'll bring you into the queue to answer this question. This is the fifth day question. The first question was a catch-up from day four. Now this is day five, and she's a national youth worker, known as a national youth worker. Worked in the cotton fields barefooted. Her parents were slaves before she was born. She started a school in Florida. Please give her name and the name of the school. All right, as you think of it, and then following this, top the new hour, the hour, it was 7:55 a.m., and following us will be Mother, Sister, Dr. Baiza Muhammad, and coming with Healing and Harmony for Humankind. And the question will be repeated. Okay, Ron Foster, you come on live here.
Yes.
Two-part
are we
question.
Allowed to answer twice?
Yes, you are. It's quite all right here on American Muslim 360. Just the hosts are not allowed to answer.
Oh, okay. Well, that was Mary Bethune, and she established the Mary Bethune Cookman College in Florida.
Bethune-Cookman College, that is correct. I should have asked, who did she marry? But no, I won't go there. Okay. Well, thank you so very, very kindly. And through your generosity,
I won't answer any more questions, though. That's the last one. I don't want to hog stuff. So.
I hear you. And the questions make it harder, too. But nonetheless, we know that our audience is quite knowledgeable, and we thank you for your being a participant in this morning's presentation. Ron Foster Sharif has answered the fourth and fifth day question. Alhamdulillah. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
All right, dear listening audience, this is the month, some say African American history, some say Black American history, some say the Black history, some say, can label it whatever it is, but it's a rise for humanity. It's a day of continuing for the human dignity, to bring it to the human excellence, the pole of human excellence. That is where we all that's how we all were created, to be in the excellent mold. And so we thank you. Continue to remember, read Quran, read it. Even while we're reading and studying the sunshine, the sun, the moon, the stars, the grass, the waters, whatever it is, and our own bodies, our own selves, study, read Quran, and know that there is one God. One God only. This is Martha Naila Abdullah, and we're tuning off because we're going to rejoin for Mother Sister Baiza Muhammad, Mother Sister Dr. Baiza Muhammad. But before we do, let's play another piece here from Amira.
This is and my story. This is your story. This is somebody's story. This is my story. This is your story. This is somebody's story.
A man wrote a story of me and a story of you. But is it true? He said that you would accomplish this and that I would accomplish that. But is it a fact? Does it hold substance, or are there some details that he lacked? He spoke of the morals that I lacked. He told me how my life dreams would fall through the cracks. He told me of the wild monkey that rode upon my back. He told wild tales of how I would fail and at what age I would go to jail.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.